wall, there is a kind of loneliness. And when we see him, this Akos, we are never sure whether he is an enemy or a brother. There are parts of us that reflect on hazy memories of chasing him through fields or laughing with him across a dinner table, and others that see him as a catalyst for trouble, a factor of unpredictability in a plan that must remain predictable. He did, in fact, bring about our ruination, inspiring Syra's betrayal, facilitating her escape, driving her toward renegades and exiles alike. But he did it for us as much as he did it to destroy us. And we are always holding those two opposing forces in tension. We are getting better at holding things in tension. Two histories, two names, two minds. We are becoming more of an I. We are watching him, the Oracle's hand covering his, a plate of fruit in front of us to appease one appetite when it happens. A sudden jerk, like a hook caught around a rib and pulling inexorably. But it is not the rib cage of this body that is pulled. It is our combined being. The Aija and the Rizek, the Shotet and the Thuvasit. The very all of us. And then we are a ship. Not a small transport vessel or a passenger floater, but a warship. Long and narrow, sleek at the top and bottom, but craggy on the side like the face of a cliff. We descend through a dense layer of clouds, white and cold and vaporous. When we break through the cloud layer, much of the land beneath us is also pale. A distant, stark white, shifting into beige and gold and brown, as the land warms along the equator. Then we are not a ship, but a child, small, standing near the edge of a packed clay rooftop. We scream for a father as the dark shape descends, casting a shadow over the city. A city of patchwork, part of us recognizes. The city of Voa. Is it the Sojourn ship? We ask our father as he comes to stand beside us. No, our father says. And we are gone again. We are not a child, but a maintenance worker, dressed in coveralls that are patched at the knees. We have both hands buried in an instrument panel, a tool between our teeth as we feel for the right part. Pressure around our abdomen and thighs tells us we are in a harness, and we dangle from the anchor higher up on a metal face. We are on the Sojourn ship, part of us helpfully suggests. Making repairs. A shadow falls over us, and we tilt our head back to see the smooth underside of a ship. Its name is painted across its bottom, in a language we do not recognize and cannot read, but we know this ship is not Shotet. We are a woman with a scarf wrapped tightly around her neck, bunched beneath her chin, and we are running toward the Sojourn ship with a child's hand clasped in ours. We carry a heavy sack over one shoulder. It is soft with clothing, but the corner of a book pierces our side with every other footstep. Come on, we say to the child. We'll be safe on the Sojourn ship. Come on. We are a younger woman with a screen in hand, standing at the loading bay doors as a crush of people fight to make their way inside the ship. We cling to a handle on the wall to stay steady as people push and push and push. We shout to a young man behind us, "How many have evacuated so far?" "A few hundred," the man shouts back. We look up at the big, dark ship. A set of doors opens on its underbelly, and another. A huge section of metal pulls apart, showing an open hatch right above us. The ship has come to hover right over the Sojourn ship, which is perched on a metal island across the sea from Voa, so that we can repair it and improve it in time for the next Sojourn. Are they deploying ships? We demand, though we know the man behind us has no answer. Something falls from the rectangle, something big and heavy and glinting in the sun. And then, brilliant, blinding light. We are the child on the rooftop again, watching as light so white, so scorching, envelops the sojourn ship and radiates out like rays from the sun. But the rays are curled, like roots, like veins, like the dark fingers that cradled the traitor Syrah Noavec's face as she killed our sovereign. The brightness sprawls across the ocean, sending water scattering away so it swells, huge, toward the shores of Voa. The brightness burns through clouds, reaching as high as the atmosphere, or so it seems. It is a wall of light that collapses all at once, like two hands clapping together. And then wind. Wind so strong it roars in our ears and makes them ring. Wind so strong it knocks us, not just over, but a few feet forward, slamming into the clay of the roof. It rushes over us, and we lose consciousness. We are hundreds of slowing hearts.
Chapter 19. Syrah. I stood with the Shotet exiles around the screens in the mess hall. All of us pressed together. Enemies, friends, lovers, strangers. We were shoulder to shoulder, watching as the sojourn ship was ripped to shreds. It was 100 things, the sojourn ship. Our history. Our freedom. A sacred vessel. A workplace. A symbol. A project. An escape. A home. As I watched the footage play again and again, I thought of clearing my mother's closet of all her clothes and shoes, too small and dainty for me to wear myself, for the most part. I had found secrets tucked away in her pockets and shoeboxes, love letters from my father, when he was a gentler man, labels from bottles of pain medication, and wrappers from the drugs she took to escape. Another woman's lip paint, smeared on a scarf, from an affair. The story of her imperfect life, told in stains and scraps of paper. And I had filled that space with my own story, my splattered stove, the suits of armor that glinted when the lights I strung over my bed struck them, and the rows upon rows of footage from other worlds, dancing and fighting and building and fixing. They were not just objects, but escapes when pain made it hard for me to stay in my own body. My comforts in despair. It had also been the place where I fell in love. And now it was gone. The fourth time the footage played, I felt fingers against mine. I pulled away instinctively, not wanting to transfer my current gift to someone else. But the hand found mine, insistent. I turned to see Tekka at my side, her eye welling up with tears. Maybe she wanted my pain, or maybe she wanted to offer me comfort. Either way, I held on to her, keeping most of my current gift to myself, as much of it as I could. Her grip lasted only for a moment or two, but it was enough. We stood and watched the footage play again, and we did not look away. Later, I pressed my face to my pillow and sobbed. Akos climbed into my bunk and curled his body around mine, and I allowed it. "I told them to evacuate," I said. "I'm the reason there were so many people on that ship." "You tried to help," Akos said. "All you did was try to help." It wasn't reassuring. What a person tried to do didn't matter. What mattered was the result. And the deaths of hundreds were the result here. That loss was my responsibility. In a fair world, I would have marked every single life on my arm to carry them around forever. But I did not have enough skin for that. Akos held me tighter, so I could feel his heartbeat against my spine as I began to sob again. I fell asleep with the press of wet fabric against my face.
Chapter 20. Sizi. Confirmed. Code 0503-2011. Proceed. Some moments you put into a little file in your mind because you know they're important, and what Issei Benazit says to signal the attack on Voa is one of those. She says it clearly, every consonant crisp, and she doesn't hesitate. When she's done, she pushes back from the desk where she was speaking to General Fenn, stands up, and walks away, brushing off Ast's outstretched hand. It doesn't take long for the attack to start, for the anti-current blast Pitha loaned us to fly toward Thuva on a special ship designed for just this purpose. The crew of the ship is Pithar, but it's General Fenn, the commander of Thuva's armed forces, who actually presses the button, per Thuvazit law. I imagine the hatch doors opening at his touch, and the weapon, long and narrow, with squared edges, falling, falling, falling. There's poetry in it, in that poetry can be raw and cruel and strange, like this. Issei, Ast, and I watch it from her quarters. The assembly ship is facing the sun then, so the walls are opaque, and they show an image of Shissa in the swirling snow. The little flakes get stuck to the sights that captured the footage every now and then, so the image is blurry most of the time. White blobs right up against the dark night sky. Between them, though, I see the buildings hanging from the clouds like drops of rain suspended in time. Shissa isn't home, but it's where I went to school, where I found a life away from my mom and her constant prophecies. So I still love it there. Shissa is what I'm looking at when the news footage comes up on the screens, and I see only a flash of the Sojourn ship's destruction before closing my eyes against it. Issei stifles a sharp sound. "What is it?" Ast says. No robotic guide beetle can help him with something on a screen, after all. "There were people around it. Did you see?" Issei says. "Why were there people around it?" I turn up the volume on the news feed just in time to hear, "Initial reports suggest there were a few hundred Shotet around the craft, attempting to evacuate the city." I turn the screen off. "A few?" Issei gasps. "A few hundred?" Ast shakes his head.
"Stop that, Issei. Casualties were still minimal."
"Minimal," I say. And it's all I can manage. General Fenn's estimates said casualties would be around 36, not hundreds.
"Yeah," Ast says, eyeballing me. "Minimal. Compared to what could have been. That's why you suggested the Sojourn ship, remember?"
There's a flow of words in my mind. Hundreds. Men. Women. Children. Old. Young. Middle-aged. Kind. Cruel. Desperate. People. 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 But I stop it. Like two hands clapping around an insect to kill it. I am better at this than I should be, after too many tragedies poisoned my memories. It's how I survive. I don't answer, Ast. I am tired of the way he prods at me, I pull back on my gift as hard as I can, hoping that if Issei feels less comfortable, she'll call him off. She's facing the swirls of snow, arms folded. The Shissa buildings in the footage light up green, purple, pink. They remind me of the baubles they sold at the Hesse market when the planting started, for people to hang in their windows for luck. Issei's shoulders shake. Shudder, really. She slaps a hand against the glass to steady herself. Ast and I both stand, eager to comfort, even though I'm sure he doesn't know how any more than I do. Issei is hunched, turning so I can see the side of her face. She's laughing. All those people, she gasps, wrapping her free arm around her stomach. Bowled right over. Ast's face goes slack with horror. But I know what this is. Issei, I say, take a deep breath. All those... Issei bends at the knees. Her hand squeaks against the glass as it slides down. I walk to the bathroom and run cold water over a washcloth to soak it all the way through. I carry it back to her, dripping all over the floor. She is crouched next to the window, laughing, sobbing. I put the wet cloth on the back of her neck and run a hand over her back. Ast finally seems to catch on, a bit late, I think, but he seems dense that way. And he urges Pazha forward with a whistle, so its clicking guides him to us. He crouches near us, silent but present. It's the closest he and I have ever been to each other, sharing air. All those people, she whimpers. I watch Ast's reaction as I unfurl my current gift like a banner and drape it over all three of us. For once, he doesn't object. I miss her, she whispers later, and we sit together by the window and watch the current stream. I take her hand and press it to my cheek. I show her a memory of Ori asleep at our kitchen table, slumped over a detailed sketch of an ice flower. There was ink smeared on her cheek. My father sipped his tea, smiling fondly down at her, and my mother clicked her tongue, though her eyes still smiled. My father bent to ease his arms around her and carried Ori to the living room. I watched her long legs bounce up and down with his footsteps. Well, my mother said to me, we do call it Ori's room, after all. Issei and I drift gently out of the memory, her hand still pressed between my cheek and my palm, and she smiles at me. I'm holding her together, I think. And what happens when I can't anymore?
2. Kirta. Noun. In Ogryn, that which has been crushed into a new shape.
Chapter 21. Sizi. The descent to Agra almost kills me. It took some doing, and some careful use of my current gift, but I convinced Issei to let me go to the Shotet exiles to start peace talks. We can work together to unseat Lazmet. The exiles are not our enemies. Their goals are aligned with ours. It took a while for my words to take root, and even now, she's still skeptical. But she did agree to let me suss out the situation at least. 7 days after the attack on Voa, she secures me a spot on a transport carrying food to Agra. I squeeze into a seat between a massive crate of fruit engineered in an Othir lab and a refrigerator packed with bird meat from Trella. The crew is Trellan, a language I don't speak, so I can't join in when they joke with each other. And Trellan is spoken in a monotone, so I can't even pretend I'm listening to music. They smile at me every now and then, so I know they don't mind me, but that's no surprise. No one minds me, even if they haven't quite figured out why. Then the ship's captain, who is thick through the legs and shoulders, with a tuft of chest hair poking out the top of his shirt, tells me in broken Otherian, "Buckle. Now." It's lucky, maybe, that no one told me what to expect, because I might have made them turn back. All the lights on the ship go off at the same time, and then I'm screaming, and it's dark, and I'm screaming. I can't breathe, and I'm sure then that the ship is running out of air, and I'm going to die here in a pile of meat. I'm clinging so hard to the straps covering my chest that my hands go numb, or maybe that's from terror. The last thing I think is that I never even got to speak to Mom again. Then the lights come back on, and gravity catches me, and the crew are all staring at me like I sprouted a third eye. They laugh, and I try to join them, but really I'm just focused on breathing. It's not long before we're standing on Ogryn soil. An Ogryn woman named Issa, Issa, she says to me slowly when I don't get it the first time around, takes me to the exiles in a little boat that cuts like a knife through the light-streaked water. She speaks Otherian like she's counting beans, dropping words one by one. But it's the only language we have in common, so we trade nonsense until we reach solid ground again. She walks me through the uneven streets of a village where Shotet and Ogryns live side by side. Issa points things out to me. A stall of polished stones she likes. The place where she buys her groceries. The tiny carved dolls that gave her nightmares as a child. She doesn't explain how they know what night is here. And when she gestures, the glowing bracelets around her wrist clatter together. "Which one is your brother?" she asks me. "Very tall, fair-skinned, like you," I say. "He came with Syra Noavak." "Oh, the heavy one," she says. "Heavy?" I say, confused. "No, he's thin." "No, no, not heavy in body. He carries a weight," she says. "I don't know the word." "Oh. I've never thought of my brother that way. The tall, deadly man who fought his way out of a Shissa hospital and into an amphitheater prison didn't seem weighed down by anything. If anything, he seemed faster and lighter than everyone around him. But maybe I just can't really see him. There is a special kind of sight that comes with not knowing someone your whole life, and Issa has it. "I will take you to where they gather," Issa says. "He may be there, and he may not." "That's fine, thank you," I say. She leads me to an old warehouse with cracks climbing up the outer walls. There's a sign fixed above the door with some characters on it I can't read. They look Shotet. We walk in, and it definitely feels like a Shotet place, in all the ways I've been taught to expect. All the tables have been pushed back against the walls, and people are either sitting at them or perched on top of them, in a kind of ring. As we walk in, people are pounding on the tables in a rolling rhythm, so loud it's all I can focus on at first. Then I look at what's happening in the middle. Syra Noavak, her hair and a long tail behind her, is throwing her body at a giant of a man. She is graceful and strong, like a knife thrown by a skilled hand. The large man, and he must be large to make a woman of her stature look so dainty, catches her, wrestles her over his shoulder, and hurls her away. I gasp as she topples to the floor, which is covered with mats, but still looks hard enough to hurt. But she's already rolling over like her body is made of rubber, grinning, a ferocity in her eyes I recognize. It's the way she looked at Rizek Noavak before he peeled the skin from her skull. And it's the way Issa looked right before she committed murder. With a yell, she throws herself at him again, and the crowd roars. It goes on this way for a while, with Syra building speed and determination before my eyes. It's the speed that seems to unsettle her opponent. He doesn't know where to look, or how to block what she throws his way, though it doesn't do much damage. She tries to tackle him, and he catches her, trapping her, only for her to twist her body around him like a necklace. She locks her legs around his neck, and he chokes. He taps one of her legs with one hand, and she releases him, sliding to the ground. The crowd roars, and she moves to the side to chug water from a spout near the windowsill. "They do this all the time now," Issa says. "I am not sure what the goal is. Do they intend to fight the Thuvazites, one-on-one?" Syra spots me across the room. The spark in her eyes dies. She comes toward me, and when she's closer, I see bruises and scratches up and down her bare arms, probably from other fights. Issa edges closer to me, putting a shoulder in front of me. "I was asked to ensure Miss Kariseth's safety among you," Issa says to her. "Please don't make that task difficult for me." Syra stops, right around spitting distance, and for a tick, I think that's what she's going to do. Spit at me. Instead, she demands, "What are you doing here?" She holds up a hand. "Don't pull that current gift shit on me. I've got no use for ease right now." It's so automatic, I didn't even realize I was doing it. I pull back as much as I can. Her current shadows have buried themselves under her skin again, and they cover her in dark webs. She grits her teeth. "I'm here to..." I pause. I don't want to give myself away. "I'm here to see my family, all right?" "You're not welcome," she says. "Or did the declaration of war escape your attention?" I wish, not for the first time, that I could turn my own gift on myself, set myself at ease, just for a little while. But I can't soothe away the lump in my throat or ease off the weight of guilt. I helped Issei pick her target. Before I got here, I felt confident that I did something good, considering the options I had. I talked her down from hitting Voa head-on, didn't I? I had saved quite a few lives with nothing but a clever tongue and my current gift. But right now I'm standing among people who lost something. Friends. Family. A place that was special to them, maybe even sacred. So how can I feel like I did something good? How can I think that these people are any different from my own, any more worthy of violence or loss? I can't. I don't. But I'll do what I have to, just like anybody. "Just tell me where to find Akos," I say.
"Akos," she snorts. "You mean my faithful servant, determined to die for me?"
Her eyes close for a tick.
"Yeah, I know where to find him. It's just down the road."
Chapter 22. Syra. Everything hurt, but I no longer cared. Well, I did, because no one wanted to be in pain. It was a survival instinct. But insofar as my rational mind was capable of overcoming my physical state, I embraced the pain. I let it throw me into frantic motion. I was sweat-soaked and exhausted and ready for more. Anything to make it easier to be this burning, writhing thing I had become. I didn't want to take Sisi Kariseth to the quiet place Akos had claimed as his own in the wake of the attack, the old woman's shop off an alley in Gallo. There was too much of him there, in the bubbling pots and tap of the knife against the cutting board. As Sisi, Issa, and I exited the cafeteria, a young woman, with densely curled hair cut short, spat on the ground near my feet. "Oruzo," she called me. The literal translation was,
a mirror image. But the real sense of the word was that one person had become another, or was so similar to them as to be indistinguishable. So, after the attack on Voa, many of the exiles had taken to calling me Oruzo, successor to Rizek, to Lazmet, to the Noavek family. It was a way to blame me for all the lives lost in the failed evacuation, because of my foolishness. If I hadn't sent that message to them, telling them to flee. But time could not run backward. I walked too fast for Issa and Sizi to keep up, so that I wouldn't have to speak to them. Sizi had gone to be with that woman, the one who had destroyed my home, and I would not forget. Akos was hunched over a pot when I reached the shop, dipping a finger in whatever he was brewing, likely a painkiller, as his perceived duty to me was his only motivator these days. He sucked the fingertip, tasting what he had made, and swore, loudly, in Thuvazit.
"Wrong again?"
the old woman asked him. She was sitting on a stool, peeling whatever it was into a bowl at her feet. "The only thing I'm good for, and I can't even get it right," he snapped. He looked up at me and flushed bright red. "Oh," he said. "Hi. I'm here to..." I paused. "Your sister is here." I stepped aside to reveal her. They stood at that distance from each other for a few long, quiet moments. He turned off the burner and crossed the room, folding her into a hug. She squeezed him back. "What are you doing here?" he asked her softly.
"I'm here to open peace talks with the exiles," she said.
I snorted. Not only was her mission ridiculous, how could we have peace talks with a nation that had destroyed the sojourn ship? But she had also lied to me about it.
"I'm sorry I lied to you," she added over her shoulder to me. "I thought you were going to hit me, so I reached for the most convenient excuse to be here."
"Syra would never hit you," Akos said.
The way he said it, without hesitation or doubt, made my chest ache. He was the only one who had ever thought so well of me.
"If you are all going to stand around chatting, do it somewhere else," the old woman said, getting to her feet. "My shop is too small and my fuse too short for such nonsense."
"I'm sorry for the waste of your ingredients, Zenka," Akos said to her.
"I learn a great deal from your failed attempts as well as your successful ones,"
Zenka said to him, not unkindly.
"Now go."
Her lined face turned to me, and she gave me a look of appraisal.
"Miss Noavek,"
she said as I retreated into the alley, by way of greeting. I nodded back and slipped away. There was no room to walk side by side in the alley, so we filed down it one by one, with Issa in the lead and Akos bringing up the rear. Over Issa's shoulder, I saw Sifa and Aija waiting for us in the hard-packed street beyond the alley. Sifa pretended to be interested in the little glowing fish at the stall nearest to her, kept in tall cylinders full of water, but I wasn't fooled. She was waiting for us. Aija looked nervously over his shoulder. His hair was curling behind his ears now, grown out enough to show its natural texture. There was a slim ribbon sewed into the shoulders of his shirt, and it glowed a faint blue. Most people here adopted some elements of Ogryn dress, so they would be visible in the dark. Not me, though. I knew I had no place here, at this impromptu Karaseth reunion, which was probably orchestrated by the Oracles, if Sifa and Aija's presence meant what I thought it did. I moved to leave, meaning to disappear into the constant night. But Akos knew me too well. I felt the shock of his hand pressing against the small of my back.
It was brief, but it sent a shiver through me. Do that again, I thought. Never do that again, I also thought. Sorry, he said, in low Shotet. But would you stay? Behind him, Sisi and Sifa embraced, Sifa's hand running over Sisi's curls with a tenderness I remembered from my own mother. Akos's gray eyes, set now in a face more sallow than it had any right to be, begged me to stay. I had distracted myself from him in the week since the attack, refusing most of the comfort he offered, unless it was in the form of a painkiller. I couldn't let myself stay close to him now, knowing that he was only here because of his own fatalism. He made me weak, though. He always had. Fine, I said. I hoped you would come, Sifa was saying to Sisi, whose eyes were on Aija. He held himself at a distance from the others, plucking at his cuticles. His posture and gestures were still like those of my late brother. It was disconcerting. Aija thought it was likely, she continued. He's only a beginner, but his intuition is strong, so we came to facilitate a particular path.
Ah, you're admitting to it this time? I said, my arms crossed to disguise the clench of my hands.
Akos's fingertips touched one of my elbows, sending the pain away. I didn't let myself look at him. Yes, Sifa said. Her hair was in a pile of curls on top of her head, a hat pin stuck through the middle of it so it stayed in place. The little jewels at the end of the pin glowed pale pink.
Come. We're wanted elsewhere.
Probably, Aija qualified.
Probably, Sifa repeated.
You're not making me want to spend more time with oracles, I said. Akos's lips twitched into a smile.
And what a shame that is, Aija replied dryly. Our loss, I'm sure.
I stared at him. I had never heard Aija Karaseth make a joke before, particularly not at my expense. There was no time to retort, because I turned and saw a menacing sight. The outline of an Ogryn transport vessel. Its edges were lined with white tubes of light, but the persistent dark flattened them, making the whole thing look like the face of a beast hanging in the air. Tucked back wings became ears. A vent beneath the forward fuselage was a mouth, and the tail was a single horn. An Ogryn in a flight suit came toward us. His skin was dark brown, but his eyes were iridescent, like the scales of a fish. They caught all the light around them and tossed it back, silvery bright. A manifestation of his current gift, I was certain, though what it did was as yet a mystery. Somewhere to my right, Issa uttered what sounded like an Ogryn curse word under her breath.
Chapter 23, Akos. Akos tried to get a sense of the Ogryn ship in the dark, but it was difficult. When they first landed on Agra, he thought the sky was always the same, but that wasn't the case. Sometimes it was velvet black, sometimes worn black, sometimes almost blue. And now, with the sky at its darkest, the ship all but disappeared, but for the light they had used to mark its shape. Issa stepped forward. Perry, hello. She didn't sound cold exactly, just as she never really sounded warm. But something had changed in her. She knew this person. Issa, the Ogryn said, I'm surprised to find you here. I was sent to be an ambassador from our people to the Shotet, she said. There was definitely something off about the two of them, Akos decided, There was too much familiarity in the way they spoke to each other. Ex-lovers, maybe? And you're surprised to find me among them? I meant here, with two oracles of Thuva, the man called Perry said. But maybe that was foolish of me. Akos felt Syra shift under his hand, getting restless. Sure enough, she was already opening her mouth. State your business, would you? She said. We've got a family reunion happening here. Miss Novak, you were just as anticipated, Perry said with a wide smile. My business is that of the Oracle of Agra. You have, all of you, been summoned by her, and I am tasked with taking you to her immediately. She is on the other side of Agra, on the edge of the wilderness, so we must fly there to make it on time. Of course, Akos thought, with no small amount of scorn. His mom and Aija had come into the village, where they almost never went, for just this reason. He hated the feeling of it, all the threads of fate coming together and tangling in a knot, the only other times in his life he had felt it happen. His dad had ended up killed, or he had killed Vas. Vas, his face shining with sweat, a bruise at the corner of his eye from who knows what. And if we don't want to go, Syra said. That would be unwise, Perry said. According to Agrin law, the Oracle's summons must be obeyed. And as a Shotet exile, you are obligated to obey our highest laws, unless you want to compromise your own refugee status. Syra glanced at Akos. Oracles, he said with a shrug, because there wasn't much more to say. The inside of the Agrin ship was downright startling. It was alive in a way Akos had never seen, didn't think a ship could be. The structure was metal, but there were plants growing everywhere, some behind glass, some out in the open. He recognized a couple of them from what Zenka had taught him, though he'd only seen them shriveled or sketched or chopped up. One of the plants behind glass looked like a perfect globe until its thick, jagged petals peeled apart, revealing the same teeth he had learned to grind into a powder. It snapped at him as he walked by. Cece went to one of the others, a flowered vine that twisted around one of the ship's support beams, like she was pulled there by a magnet. A dark green tendril reached for her finger and wrapped around it, gentle. Akos rushed to her side and flicked it to make it back off. Apparently they start off friendly and turn fierce, he said to her. But if you ignore them, they don't usually do anything. Do all the plants here try to kill you? Cece said. Almost all, he said. Some try to befriend you so you'll defend them against other plants. You'll notice there are almost no animal species on Agra, Perry said as he walked past them. That is because the plants are so highly developed. There is a wide variety of insect species for the propagation of plant life, but we are the only warm-blooded beasts that walk this planet. Perry settled into the captain's chair. There was no co-pilot or first officer that Akos could see, just Perry and a stretch of buttons and switches and levers. Issa took the seat beside him, though. The forward fuselage was big enough to fit all of them, on bench seats with protective straps. Given what Akos knew about the planet's tendency to fight back against everything, everywhere, he thought they needed more than some straps to protect them, but nobody had asked him. Did the Oracle say why she wanted us dragged to her? Syra said, while she was strapping herself in. She finished her own buckles and then reached over, unconsciously it seemed like, to help Cece with hers. Akos took the seat on her other side at the end of the bench. It's not for me to ask, Perry said. The oracle is not very... Issa paused, searching out the word in Othirian. She asked in Shotet, "How do you say forthright?" Akos repeated the word in Othirian for Sisi. "It is not an oracle's job to answer questions like those," Sifa said. "We have only one job, and that is to protect this galaxy. Sorting through the inconsequential information that other people find essential is not up to us." "Oh, you mean inconsequential information like you, my youngest son, you're going to get kidnapped tomorrow?" Syra snapped. "Or Issa Benazit is about to murder your brother, Syra, so you may want to make your peace with him?" Akos grabbed a handful of his own leg to steady himself. He wanted to tell Syra not to use his pain as a weapon against his own mom. He wanted to tell his mom that Syra had a point, but he felt so heavy with the hopelessness of it that he gave up before he started. "You demand to know things from the Ogryn Oracle that you will find out within the day," Sifa snapped. "You're angry that you aren't told what you want to know exactly when you want to know it. What a frustrating existence you must find this, that it doesn't meet your every need for you instantaneously." Syra laughed. "As a matter of fact, I do find it frustrating." She had been this way since the Sojourn ship attack, Akos thought. Primed for a fight no matter what form it came in, no matter who it was with. Syra was always prickly, and he liked that about her. But this was different. Like she kept throwing herself at a wall in the hope that one of these days it might finally break her apart. "Quiet on deck," Perry announced. "Can't focus with all of you arguing." Issa joined in the dance of readying the ship, and the way they did it together, Perry and Issa, made Akos think they had done it 100 times before. Their arms crossed, fair and freckled against dark and unblemished, and stretched past each other without getting in each other's way, the choreography of familiarity. The ship lurched and shuddered as it rose from the ground. The engines roared, and the vines and plants twitched and fluttered like the wind was blowing. Akos watched the flowered vine curl more tightly around its support beam. The plant behind glass curled into itself and glowed orange in warning. "We'll be flying above the storm to avoid its damage," Perry said as the ship flew up and forward. "It will be rough." Akos couldn't help his own curiosity. They'd been hiding from the storms whenever the alarm went off since they arrived on Agra, almost every day it felt like. But he'd yet to hear a good description of what the storms were, exactly. The ship's flight wasn't as smooth as a Shotet ship's. It jerked and shivered, and from what Akos could tell, it was slow. But they got up high enough that he could see the little glowing patches of villages, and then the big, bright splotch of Agra's capital city, Pokgo, where the buildings were tall enough to make a jagged horizon. The ship turned as it climbed, away from Ogryn civilization and toward the stretch of dark that made up the southern forests. There were plenty of glowing things there, as there were everywhere else, but they were covered by dense greenery, so from a distance it was difficult to see anything but void. The ship jerked up, which made Akos grab blindly for Syra's hand. He didn't mean to squeeze hard, but judging by her laugh, that's what he was doing. The clear view they'd had of Agra's surface was gone, replaced by the dense swirl of clouds. And then, up ahead, color and light coalescing, just like they had when the Sojourn ship passed through the current stream. A blue line of lightning cut through the cloud layer and stretched down. The ship jostled Akos's head from side to side so hard he could hear his own teeth clattering together. Another flash, this one yellow, seemed to happen right next to them. Perry and Issa were shouting things at each other in Ogryn. Akos heard retching as someone, Aija probably, he'd always had motion sickness, threw up. Akos watched as Agra took the glowing colors the rest of the planet boasted so proudly and hurled them right back, brutal and relentless. As Perry promised, they moved right over the storm, which jostled them all but didn't down the ship. The acrid smell of vomit, combined with the constant shuddering of his head, made him want to be sick himself, but he tried to keep it down. Even Syra, who usually loved things that made other people scared out of their minds, looked like she had had enough, her teeth gritted even though he was taking care of her current gift. It took a long time for Perry to announce that they were landing. Next to him, Syra heaved a sigh of relief. Akos noted the shift of the ship toward the ground, aiming at some dense forest that looked the same to him as everywhere else. But as they came closer, the trees seemed almost to part, making way for a cluster of buildings. They were lit from beneath by pools of glowing water, saturated by the same bacteria that made the canals around Gallo light up, Akos assumed. Otherwise, they were small wooden buildings with high peaked roofs, connected by paths that looked bright against the otherwise gloomy backdrop. Spots of light moved erratically everywhere, tracing the paths of flying insects. The ship touched down just inside a stone wall on a landing pad. They were at the Temple of Agra.
Chapter 24. Syra. I bent to touch the path beneath our feet. It was smooth, flat stone. White. A color uncommon to Agra. This place was packed with glowing things, in the gardens and pools, and flitting around in the air. Perry led us toward one of the larger buildings. We had landed at the bottom of a hill, so it would be a climb to get anywhere, and I assumed the Oracle resided at the top. The air tasted sweet after the stale panic inside the transport vessel. I never wanted to travel during an Agran storm again, and I gulped it down, keeping pace with Perry, with the others behind me. As we passed through one of the gardens, most of the plants were held away from us by a mesh fence that had a current running through it, I noted. Issa spoke from behind me, with a tone of controlled fear. Perry? I turned back to see a large beetle, almost as long as my palm, crawling on Akos's cheek. Its wings had bright blue markings, and its antennae were bright, searching. There was another one on his throat, and a third on his arm. "Stay still," Issa told him. "Everyone else step back from him."
"Shit," Perry said. "I take it these insects are poisonous," Akos said. His Adam's apple bobbed with a particularly hard swallow.
"Very," Issa said. "We keep them here because they are very bright when they fly."
"And they avoid anything that is a particularly strong conduit for the current," Perry added. "Like people. Most people."
Akos's eyes closed. Frowning a little, I stepped forward. Perry grabbed my arm to stop me, but he couldn't stand to touch me. His grip slipped, and I kept walking. Inching closer and closer, until I was right in front of Akos, his warm breath against my temple. I lifted a hand to hover over the beetle on his face, and, for the first time, thought of my current gift as something that might protect instead of injure. A single black tendril unfurled from my fingers, obeying me, and jabbed the beetle in the back. The light inside it flaring to life, it darted away from him, and the others went with it. Akos's eyes opened. We stared at each other, not touching, but close enough that I could see the freckles on his eyelids. "Okay?" I said. He nodded. "Stay close to me, then," I said. "But don't touch my skin, or you'll turn us both into poisonous insect magnets." As I turned around, I made eye contact with Sifa. She was giving me an odd look, almost like I had just struck her. I felt Akos behind me, staying close. He pinched my shirt between two fingers, right over the middle of my back.
Well, I just said. That was exciting.
It was the sort of thing Rizek might have said.
Shut up, I replied, automatically.
There were beautiful, expansive rooms on the hill. Grand spaces, the furniture covered with protective cloths, the planks of the wood floors stained in different patterns, the tiles painted with geometric designs in sedate greens and muted pinks. The warm Ogryn air flowed easily through each space we walked through, most of the walls built to fold back. But Perry didn't take us to any of them. Instead, he brought us to the series of buildings where we would stay overnight.
She wants to see each of you separately, so it will take some time, he said. This is a peaceful place, so take advantage of the opportunity to rest.
Who gets to go first? I said.
The Oracle's esteemed colleague, Sifa Karaseth, of course,
Perry said, inclining his head to Akos's mother.
I am honored, Sifa said, and they walked away together, leaving me, Akos, Aija, Sizi, and Issa.
Anything we should know? I said to Issa. You used to live here, I assume. You seem to know as much about it as Perry does.
Yes, Perry and I both worked here once, before I was sent to be an ambassador, she said.
She switched into Shotet.
I'm afraid I have nothing useful to say except that the Oracle is far more than she initially seems, and if she wants to see each of you separately, that is because she has something distinct to say to each of you.
Akos repeated this in Thuvazit to Sizi, on a slight delay. I had never seen Sizi look quite this way, not frightened exactly, but tense, like she was bracing herself. I didn't often think of Sizi's fate, but I thought of it then. The first child of the family Karaseth will succumb to the blade.
The little buildings where Perry had told us we could stay were arranged in a circle around a garden, and all the walls were open, so it was easy to track who came and went. Sifa didn't return from the Oracle, but Perry came to collect Aija, who was increasingly making me feel like I was in the presence of Rizek again. Akos joined me in the garden, after ensuring there were no killer beetles flying around. Still, he stayed close to me, closer than he normally would.
What do you think she'll say? I asked him.
He sighed, and I felt it against my hair.
I don't know. I've given up trying to know what oracles are going to say to me.
I laughed.
I bet you're tired of them.
I am. He stepped closer, so his chest was against my back, and his nose was in my hair, tilted down so I could feel his breaths against the nape of my neck. It would have been simple to move away. He wasn't holding me there. He was hardly touching me, in fact. But so help me, I didn't want to move.
I'm tired of everything, he said. I'm tired all the time.
He sighed again, heavily.
Mostly, he said, I'm tired of not being near you.
I found myself relaxing, shifting back so I was pressed against him, a wall of heat all the way down my spine. He rested his hands on my hips, his fingers creeping under the hem of my shirt just enough to dull my pain. Let the damn poison beetles come, I thought, as I felt a kiss on my neck, right behind my ear. This was inviting further pain, and I knew it. His fate wouldn't let him choose me, and even if that wasn't the case,
I suspected the deep well of his grief wouldn't let him choose anything at all. But I was sick of doing what was good for me. He kissed where my neck met